Yeah, so I was saying you made a very practical point that in taking the developmental history, if we try to assess what was the patient's relationship with significant people in his or her past, and then significant people in the present, then the triangle of relationships can be completed by understanding that it's quite likely that similar interactions will occur with me as the prescribing clinician and with the medication. The
Yes.
medication becomes the object of the
Yes.
transference also. And so you have some idea. It's not will not should not come as a complete surprise. And that and so my follow-up to that is that if we have a sort of a, at least, you know, even those of us who are not trained psychoanalytically have some rudimentary idea of a typical pattern, would you change how you deal interact with a particular patient based on your understanding of that person's typical relationship patterns? Would you then change how you re relate to them?
Yeah, I think of course one part of the, I think good psychiatric practice is getting a sense of who the person is
Yeah.
you're dealing with and trying to, either address that verbally or to address it in behavior. So people that are, anxious about dependency, I would probably lay that out as something we're going to pay attention to. Somebody who's, somebody who has a dismissive attachment style, for example.
Yeah.
We know the patients with dismissive attachment styles from research are more likely to be non-adherent, and that we know that clear communication reduces that effect. So somebody who has a dismissive attachment style, these are the kinds of patients who are one strike and you're out, kinds of patients that you'd upset them once. But if you are especially clear in your communication with them, they are less likely to become non-adherent.
Right. Okay.
So we take what we know about patients and their conflicts and their anxieties and, try to address it in our work.
Right. So just again to dig a little deeper into your advice. So if I know that a particular person has a fear of dependency, or let's say they fear that they will be controlled. So I guess I have two options. One is to interpret it to the patient and say, you know, it seems like you have this problem. Or the opposite could be to keep quiet, but factor that in. And try to give that patient more control in terms of the medication. Be particularly more than other patients, give this person more choices in which medicine to take and how to take it and so on. So the question, so this will be for us who are not psychoanalytically trained, the question will be, is it better to just use that information skillfully, or how important is it to discuss it with the patient?
You left out the third choice, which is to do both.
Okay, yeah.
Because I think to speak to the patient about it is authorizing. If you just are doing it kind of secretly, you're not really inviting the patient in as a partner in the same way.
Okay.
So I would speak to the patient about it, but I would also be, for example, more mindful to give that patient choices, and I would tell them. And I would probably tell them,
Okay.
given your concerns
Yeah.
about control, I think it's especially
Right.
important that I get your input about this. And so they know they're being authorized.
Yeah.
And again, this is one of the things where there's a lot of interesting research about this. Even giving patients, in one study, even giving patients the control of saying whether they want something once a day or three times a day. Increases medication adherence 2.3 times.
Right. Okay. Okay.
So it's always a good idea
Right. So that's a good.
to try to figure out where you can give patients choice. These two antidepressants or these five antidepressants, this approach or that approach, I think it's always useful
Right.
to lay out the options and listen to what the patient wants.
Yeah.
And the other, and if I could say one other
Yeah.
thing. So
Yeah.
patients come in and they've seen a commercial. So I want Lexapro or whatever because I just saw this commercial. I'll say to the patient, I think that's exactly the right medication for you.
Yeah.
And you know why? It's because the medication you want is going to work better than a medication you don't.
Yeah.
So I'm giving them what they want, but I'm also not doing it in a way that loads all of the power into the medicine.
Yeah.
It really gives the patient a good chunk of that power.
Yeah. Right. But then we may also see other patients who don't like to be given choices. They want to be taken care of. And then, mm-hmm. then they want you to be the person. You know, the life is scary for all of us. I mean, because things are so uncertain, and actually, you know, all of us are just figuring things as we go along. And there are I see patients who don't like want that, and they are afraid of all that, and they would rather see me as a person who knows more than them, mm-hmm. and can kind of guide them, hold them firmly, and guide them in the right direction. So the question in that situation is: should I go ahead? And realizing that this person is anxious, and should I just shepherd them in the direction that I think is best for them? Or should I, in all cases, give them choices and in the belief that in the long term, that will be liberating?
That's a really good question. And I like what you said about life is scary.
Yeah.
You know, like that's part of that. I would imagine that would be part of the discussion I would have with the patient is noticing that life is scary, and they do want me to have all of the, you know, to be the expert, to know what they should do. And in some way to you know, in part of, in the kind of relationship that I'm developing, to be saying, though, we also do know that the more choice they have, the more they're able to state a preference, the better it will be. And to be working on that. And, you know, of course, if they can't, or if they really need me to, you know, I will say, you know, so I mean, if I would pick this one, but I would be constantly working at trying to create a space for that patient to feel safe, for that patient to feel more authorized, and doing it like you did in an empathic way, recognizing the real anxiety that is behind that wish to turn themselves over to somebody else.
Okay, so this gels with the previous example you gave. So you're saying in both cases that, yes, take into account and give them what they need to some extent, but also discuss with them that need and where it comes from and how they can also do both at the same time.
Yes.
In both these cases. Now, what about a slightly different question? So as the person comes in and you said we discuss with them, you know, that we are together trying to understand what's going on and what we should do, patients often express reluctance about medication. Because they feel like they have so many side effects, they won't, you know, it'll numb their feelings and so on and so forth. How often would you be inclined to like not prescribe medication in such a patient until these concerns can be explored? Because my experience has been that if you plow ahead and insist that no, you really, it's very important, it's a chemical imbalance, and you really need to take the medication, the treatment will be sabotaged in some way or the other.
Yes. Yeah. No. So my basic practice would be, you know, to convey to a person, I want to understand you first.
Yeah.
You know, if you plow ahead too quickly, it's so easy for them to feel, you know, that you're invested in your own thing.
Yeah.
So to say, you know, I want to understand who you are first, to develop something of an alliance, and you know, it may only take a session or two to have the patient start to feel like, you know, they can trust you. But for somebody like that who is worried about control, I certainly would tend to slow things down. Now, of course, somebody is, you know, in the midst of a manic episode or something like that, it's a different thing. But if somebody's coming in a non-emergent state, it often makes sense to allow the patient to understand. You want to know who they are first so that you can make recommendations. And also, you know, to really respect, to for them to understand that you understand their reluctances, and that you can actually really appreciate where they're coming from, so they don't feel like you're just pushing something on them. And if you do that, you know, you may be less likely to prescribe medications. You may be in it with the patient in a way that they feel like, you know, you're willing to try without it, but you're also there to say, you know, it doesn't look like it's working, and you've developed trust.
Yeah.
At that point. And I will also add that, you know, along those lines, to the extent that we can get patients to talk about the ways they expect to be harmed, you know, it's a complicated thing because on the one hand, I think the research shows that if we talk about side effects, patients are more likely to have them, you know, or what we would call the nocebo effect, the expectation-based experiences of harm. If we talk about side effects, patients will be more likely to have them. But those same patients are actually more likely to continue taking their medications.
Yes, yes. They may change the medicine.
When they get side effects, yeah. If you have been able to talk about them ahead of time.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a good segue into the topic of side effects, because in your writings, you have emphasized the role of psychodynamic factors in some patients who have larger number of side effects. So this is a very frustrating clinical situation for all concerned, where you have a patient who has had every side effect possible on multiple medicines. And certainly, isn't that a situation where you should at least think that this could be, that psychodynamic factors could be at play to explain why this person has so many side effects on so many medications?
Yeah, so absolutely. So what we're talking about is the nocebo effect.
Yeah.
And yeah, for sure, if a patient has had side effects across multiple classes of medications, especially, you know, unusual side effects, I'm always on the alert for nocebo responses. And this is the kind of thing that I'm talking to patients about, you know, because they understand about the placebo response, and they know that it makes a difference, but they often don't expect or think that their expectations can also produce harm. Yeah. Now, you don't want to claim as if you know that it's a nocebo response, because again, that's authorizing, but to put that in the mix of what you and the patient are investigating.
Yeah. So what would be like a couple of examples of, like, so if we are seeing a patient who has unexpected side effects in terms of number or severity and so on, so what would be a couple of reasons, psychological reasons, that, you know, this person could be a poor metabolizer of those medications,
right?
Possibly, my own research has shown that, but like, what would be some reasons that you have seen in your clinical experience why a person may have so many side effects? What is making them have so many side effects?
Well, I mean, on one level, of course, there are as many reasons that there are patients, you know, but, you know, certainly early adverse experiences with caregivers, I think, really predispose people to be distrustful if people have been harmed by caregivers early in life. That's just in their bones. They may not even be conscious. So you could imagine, like, somebody who was, like, a patient who was orally raped, you know, by a caregiver.
Yeah.
Right. And especially worst case scenario, under the guise of caregiving.
Yeah.
So, like, a comforting gesture becomes a caress, which becomes a grope, which progresses into something really horrifying. Now, as a doctor, you say, you know, put this in your mouth because it will make you feel calmer.
Yeah.
That, all of that patient's alarm bells are likely to be going off, although maybe not even on a conscious level.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so you could expect that somebody like that would likely have, you know, negative reactions. And like you said, it's a frustrating thing for us. And it's one of those things that when somebody's had really bad experiences like that, it takes a long time to work through that and to get to a place where a patient can benefit from medications. But there are other cases where it's less severe, and it's really around issues of control or issues of neglect or things like that, where the pills come to symbolize some other less, you know, still toxic, but less toxic forms of harm.
Yeah.
And, you know, to the extent that you can get to the bottom of those, you can ideally begin to address them.
Right. So in cases where the person has been mistreated, you know, or abused in some way, would the focus be more on building trust with the patient so that they can trust that you as the current caregiver, the clinician, are not going to mistreat them or harm them? That's what you are going to focus on first.
Well, I think that as I've said throughout, there's a couple of different things. So that is one, you know, developing trust. But I'm developing trust partly by really authorizing the patient. You know, these are people who, part of that experience of trauma is that they were profoundly disempowered.
Yeah.
So part of the trust is that they feel that they're empowered in our relationship. I don't have all the power. And part of it is also that I'm talking to them about the complexity, so that we've talked about how hard it is to know how much of their side effects is something that derives in their basic biology and how much starts in their mind and then goes into their body.
Yeah.
And again, I won't know. It's so complicated. That's something we grapple with together.
Yeah.
And so all the, if you put those three things together, that's, I think, how with a patient like this who's been traumatized, you start moving towards their being able to make better use of medications.
Right. Now, we have only a few minutes left, Dr. Min, so I wanted to just turn to asking you about the role of the prescriber psychology.
Uh-huh.
So what would be, so my first thing is, like, what would be, when treating difficult-to-treat patients, or patients with difficult-to-treat illness, as the case might be, what would be some red flags that our countertransference is coming into play and our feelings are sabotaging the treatment?
Well, first of all, our countertransference is always coming into play.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, it is probably worth recognizing that especially the patients who use more primitive defenses, like projective identification in particular, are likely patients who will evoke countertransference responses. And by projective identification, what I mean is a defense mechanism where the patient has something they don't want to feel.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
they behave in a way that makes the doctor feel it.
Right.
So a patient who has been disempowered, right? And somewhere in their life, they decide, I will never be disempowered. I will never be under somebody's control.
Yeah.
Now, you prescribe something. Now, what they do is they take too little or too much,
yeah.
but they never take what you prescribe.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Now, who feels helpless?
I think I might have seen one or two patients like that.
Yeah. Yeah. But now, who feels helpless? They refuse to feel helpless. You feel helpless.
Yeah.
And then once a patient has started to put disavowed feelings into us, that can push us into, you know, being more strident or different things. So that's one thing. I think certainly patients that evoke feelings of desperation and helplessness, patients that are criticize us, they all can make us go to great extremes.
Yeah.
You know, these are the patients who, when I get a patient at Riggs, and we get a certain number of them, you know, who come in on, you know, two antidepressants and two or three antipsychotics and two mood stabilizers, and you know, with patients sometimes we come in on a dozen or more medications.
Yeah.
You know, and the first thing I think is that this patient has made some poor doctor suffer an awful lot.
Right.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
And so, you know, I think one of the ways that we do that is we just pay attention to the level of suffering that we have.
Yeah.
And that helps us know which patients may get us into countertransference traps.
Right. Right. So the last question I want to ask is, you know, this discussion has been very enlightening, and you know, I do realize for myself, and I hope our listeners do also, that this is a process, and you're not going to discover all these things in the first appointment, and over time you learn more and more. But isn't it a particularly a challenge in today's environment where the duration of the visits has become progressively shorter? And do you think that, you know, I hope that our listeners don't take away the message that this is an ideal form of treatment, but realistically it's not possible given that we see patients for 20, 25 minutes.
Well, I will say I see patients for 20 or 25 minutes. I mean, my initial intake might be an hour. I might do a second hour.
Yeah.
And beyond that, I'm seeing patients for 25 minutes, maybe even 15 minutes, although at a greater frequency, so maybe once a month. So much of what we've talked about are things that you know, the kind of developmental history I was talking about is a five-minute developmental history.
Right, okay.
The question about, you know, like, what would you stand to lose if this works is, you know, again, a two-minute thing.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about more is a kind of a stance that we take with a patient that invites them to be a partner with us. And that really doesn't take a lot of time at all. And in fact, there's research that shows that, for example, that eliciting patient preferences, you know, some doctors might say, well, I don't have time for that. But it actually, the research shows it does not add any length onto a patient appointment.
Right. It's an attitude that we bring.
Yes. It is much more an attitude than anything else. Now, that being said, I do think that it's likely that that the pressure to move towards 15-minute, you know, medication checks does have adverse consequences.
Yeah.
The doctor-patient relationship, the move towards putting computers between the doctor and the patient. I mean, there was just a relatively recent study that showed that in a psychiatry intake, in a naturalistic study, if the doctor interacted with their computer once, patients returning for a second appointment dropped from 72% to 27%.
Wow.
You know, so there are certainly things in our treatment environment, in our current environment, that as psychiatrists, I think we should be drawing attention to, paying attention to the evidence base and using what we know to fight, you know, those pressures within our system that are counter-therapeutic.
Right, right. But nevertheless, I'm really glad that we kind of ended with a message of hope from you, which is that it's not true that using psychodynamic principle requires you to see a patient for an hour a week or anything like that, that these principles can be applied successfully in relatively short visits.
Absolutely.
Right. Thank you so much, Dr. Mintz, for speaking to us and for giving us these valuable insights. I certainly am looking forward to seeing your book come out, where you'll provide us with more detailed guidance about that. But until that happens, you know, we will have to make do with the guidance you have provided us in this interview. And I will also link to, with references to several publications that you have done on this topic in Psychiatric Times, but also in reputed journals. And hopefully our listeners who are interested and should be interested in diving deeper will read some of them and benefit from them. So again, thank you very much.